By support from Victorian House at 408 East Main in downtown Mahomet. Victorian House specializes in unique glass art jewelry and gifts. Victorian House also offers classes in bead making and stained glass on the web at victorianhouse.biz.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of Focus today, we'll be talking about Egypt and politics in Egypt. President Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, is one of the longest-serving rulers in the Middle East. Last September, he was elected to a fifth term. Not really a surprise to anyone. However, there had been a bit of a surprise earlier in the year, that is, last winter, when he announced that for the first time there would be competitive elections for president. Now, that may not quite be what it seemed because there still were restrictions on the other parties that might run. And the biggest opposition party in the country, the Muslim Brotherhood, they weren't allowed to offer a candidate at all. At the same time, candidates of the Muslim Brotherhood did run for the parliament as independents. And perhaps the big headline on the election last fall was that the Muslim Brotherhood made some impressive gains, and that the government of Egypt continues to face pressure from both within the system and without. And you can certainly see the kind of pressure without when you look back just to last month and the bombings that took place in the resort town of Dahab. We'll be talking this morning about a little bit about all of this and about what's been going on recently in Egypt with Ken Cuno. He is associate professor of history here at the University of Illinois and is also director of the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, and has been following politics in Egypt for some time. Questions, as always, are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have toll-free line, so that if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. If we could go back and talk a little bit about what Mr. Mubarak did last, I guess it was February, I think it was February 2005, mm-hmm. when he made the announcement, and I think that it did indeed surprise some people that to the extent that it is open, that the race for the presidency would be open, that is at least that other parties would be allowed to compete. Was this indeed surprising?
Well, I think it was unanticipated, for sure, given the history of elections in Egypt and the way the system worked before. And mind you, he announced it in February, and then they had to have a plebiscite for a constitutional amendment, I think, in May. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, the system was that the parliament would nominate one candidate who would then be voted on up or down, yes or no, in plebiscite, and that was how he was elected for his previous 25 years. So this time they had to amend it, yes, and the election. Ultimately, there were a total of 10 candidates, including Mubarak. 9 opposition candidates were approved, and that vote was in September, and there was never any doubt that he would win an overwhelming majority. One of the interesting little sidelights to this is that Egyptian law provides a kind of a narrow window in which voters can register. You can't register just at any time you feel like it. Rather, you've got from sometime in November into, I think, late December or the beginning of January to register to vote in the coming cycle. So he waited until February after that window had closed. And so if there had been more interest in voting, nobody else was able to register before the presidential and then the parliamentary elections the following fall of 2005.
Mm-hmm. As I read about it, it made it sound as if even though officially it was possible for candidates of parties other than the ruling party to participate and to field a candidate, there were still restrictions placed on parties. It was not easy there, and the Muslim Brotherhood, because it's banned, they couldn't field a candidate at all.
Right.
So then the question is, well, just how free an election was this?
Well, you're looking at a baseline in the past, things have been a lot less free or a lot less open. So you've always got a starting point, you know, to measure it against. But you're quite correct that, well, first of all, the National Democratic Party, the NDP, the president's party, is the only party worthy of the name that exists and functions on a full-time basis. The so-called opposition party, the most popular one is the WAFT, and it's still very, very weak and riven with divisions internally. The Muslim Brotherhood, as you mentioned, could not field a candidate. It is officially an illegal organization, so it exists kind of in the twilight. It is also not a political party. It has never wanted to declare itself a party, and Egyptian law forbids the formation of any political party based upon religion. So as you mentioned earlier, they had to run parliamentary candidates as independents, but they weren't able to field a presidential candidate, and perhaps that was a strategic choice on their point, on their part, not to push things too far at this time. In the parliamentary elections, they did not contest every district. They deliberately limited the number of candidates they were putting up. Thinking probably of the memory of Algeria in 1991 when the Islamic Salvation Front was poised to win elections there and the army took over and canceled elections with the encouragement of the French and the Americans.
Hmm. Why did Hosni Mubarak do this?
Why did he do this? My best guess is that if you think back to early 2005, following the November American elections, President Bush was riding high. He claimed to have political capital, more of a mandate than last time. And there also, it appeared perhaps with the, I think the Iraqi elections were held close to that time. He was riding high. And so there was a lot of talk about, okay, now we're going to move forward with our agenda, democratization and so forth. And they were leaning on the Egyptians publicly more so than they have been in the past 6 to 12 months. So that's one thing. But the other thing is also there's a lot of internal pressure for reform in Egypt. Mubarak, as you mentioned, has been in charge for 25 years. And actually, I think he is now the longest serving leader in the Middle East now that Assad of Syria passed away a few years ago. And there's not much to show for it. For his leadership over 25 years, in particular in terms of economic conditions. So there were this movement called Kifaya, which means enough in Arabic, was agitating for saying, okay, he shouldn't stand for re-election this time. He should open things up and so forth. So there was a lot of pressure internally growing from the intelligentsia, from the middle class, and so a lot of dissatisfaction.
So the election takes place in the fall of last year. And again, as to no one's surprise, President Mubarak is reelected. He's elected to a fifth term. And as I understand it, the Egyptian constitution doesn't place any limits on how many terms an individual may serve. So he can serve as long as he chooses and as long as he continues to be reelected.
Egyptians say he's like a pharaoh.
And also it is said that he has been grooming his son to take over, so that brings to mind images of dynasties, certainly. He is reelected. The election takes place. Now, we talked about the fact that it may not have been free in the sense that not everyone who would have liked to participate or field a candidate could have. But given those kinds of restrictions, just look at the way the election took place. Was it, to the extent that it could be said, was it a free and fair election?
It may have been free. It certainly wasn't fair. I mean, there were widespread allegations of serious allegations by observers with credibility of fraud, voter fraud, irregularities and so forth of the usual sort. And now, of course, the presidential election was just one day, one go like that. It was more apparent in the parliamentary elections, where police and plainclothesmen, as well as armed civilians, presumably armed by the government, actually were brought in to prevent people from voting, or rather to restrict voting in certain key districts to people that they knew would vote the right way. And this was covered, well covered in the American media at the time. So, it was... It was one of these situations where with one hand, the government said, okay, we're going to have an open election and anybody can run and so forth. And then the other hand, they said, oops, now we've got to control the results.
Mm-hmm. So President Mubarak, he wins, he's reelected, and his party continues to have a majority in the parliament. Mm-hmm. But I suppose, as I said at the beginning, that the headline would be that candidates that are associated with were associated with the Muslim Brotherhood did well. So we'd say the Brotherhood did well. That was a big thing. And actually, candidates that were in associated with the secular opposition lost ground in the parliamentary election. Just how significant an outcome was this?
Well, I think it was very significant, and I think it shows a number of things, but one of the things it shows is that once you sort of open the door, you crack a little bit like this, then it's hard to keep it from opening all the way in terms of participation. And in spite of this result, the Brotherhood won 88 seats in Parliament. In the previous Parliament, they, again, as independents, got something like 15 or 17 seats only. I think that the secular opposition parties did poorly in part because they're in such disarray, and they've never even the biggest ones have never gotten beyond the point of being vehicles for just a small group of leaders, but they don't have much in the way of a program to offer alternative. The Brotherhood, on the other hand, the candidates they fielded typically were people known locally as activists who had been very involved in delivering the services that the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist organizations in the Middle East do provide, such as no-interest loans to families, clinics, low-cost or free medical service in neighborhoods where this is lacking, private schools, again, at low cost for children in a country where the government can't build enough schoolrooms for all the kids. So these, as in the case of Turkey or in Palestine, the Muslim Brotherhood candidates, the Islamists, did well because they were associated with, A, delivering the goods in terms of services, and B, being honest, and that's more important than being religious, although it goes hand in hand in people's minds, and finally, being not the government.
Mm-hmm. What is their fundamental... it's possible to answer the question. Mm-hmm. So what is their fundamental platform? What really does the Muslim Brotherhood stand for? And if they had a larger role in government, well, let's suppose that they were the majority party in the parliament, what would they do?
That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure that they know what they would do exactly because they've never held power. And, their slogan that they repeat over and over again is that Islam is the solution. And in fact, their candidates last fall were saying, right, if you just apply Islam to these problems, we'll have most of the problems fixed. Now, that does appeal to people in a situation where corruption is rampant and there's a great deal of feather bedding in the parliament. The National Democratic Party members of parliament are widely seen as simply looking after their own interests and not the interests of the constituents. So if somebody comes across as religious and has a track record already of being active, delivering goods and service, delivering services to his constituency and not being corrupt, well, that's something right there. But what their overall policy would be, it's difficult to say. They've been careful not to go much beyond these slogans, the Quran is our constitution, Islam is the solution, and so forth. In to the extent that they've made moves in the past, because they've had deputies in parliament since 1984, it's been socially conservative. They've mooted a lot of, not gotten through, but mooted a lot of suggestions as with regard to gender. Clearly, they would want to restrict the roles of women in public. And they actually have a discourse about women and the family that is not unlike the hard religious right in this country, the idea that most of our social problems derive from the breakdown of family values and the abandonment of traditional roles. And so if we've got problems with crime or with drugs, it's because women are out in the workplace and they're not staying home taking care of their kids properly. So one proposal they came up with in the late 80s was to pay women half of what they otherwise would earn in their jobs to stay at home, which also would have the virtue of helping deal with the male unemployment problem, in theory at least. Mm-hmm. Of course, that got nowhere. There's high workforce participation on the part of women in Egypt, and that's not going to go very far.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ken Cuno. He's an associate professor of history here at the University of Illinois. He's also director of the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. And we're talking about Egypt, and questions are welcome. We do have someone here who is ready to go. Others are invited. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is someone on our toll-free line, someone calling from Indiana. Line four.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a series of questions just in case, because sometimes David asks those questions, which he did about the Muslim Brotherhood. The only thing I would want to ask about that is this position, I'm sure, is the same throughout Muslim countries, that they have any kind of political base that, you know, you just talked about the social conservatism. But I have two questions. One, in our heart of hearts, and in an ideal world, if what does the United States have to politically force these countries in the Middle East, including Egypt, to, in a sense, in Bush's view, mend their ways? Do we have any political clout, or is there anything, you know, geopolitical that we can bring up at all, except, you know, we can shoot the hell out of you? And the second question deals with, I guess, those brothers, or sons, excuse me, of the president. Is there one in particular that seems to get the nod? And are situations such that they would have to protect those people, perhaps from the insurgents or the terrorists in Egypt? I just thought that was a sort of a wild question, but I just wondered if there's any sort of thing like that could possibly happen down the way. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, as for your first question, what can the U.S. Do? Well, there's different ways, I suppose, of trying to influence the situation. But what I was trying to emphasize earlier in my comments was that there's a lot of pressure building inside of Egypt for change. People are very frustrated with the situation of stasis. So I think that too often we Americans think that we can just kind of, you know, socially or politically engineer the world as we like it. And we always talk about let's do this or let's do that. But I think we should also think in terms of, first of all, how not to make the situation worse. President Bush, for example, give a counterexample, spoke out on the eve of the Iranian elections last year. You know, took the side of some reformist groups and basically said that the he didn't consider the elections to be fair, and thereby managed to discredit the liberal opposition in that country. So there are certain things you have to be careful not to do that would cause, say, a backfire to get people's nationalism up and have them dig in their heels. So I think publicly pressuring the government of Egypt on human rights issues and on issues of, for example, the candidate who did the best against President Mubarak in the September election, Ayman Nour, head of the Tomorrow Party, was convicted of fraud. Allegedly, the government alleges that he falsified documents in registering his party, and he was sentenced to a 5-year term in December, and he's still in prison right now. There's been virtually nothing said by the U.S. about this since last December, and this is completely dropped out of the mainstream media. And so there he is, and virtually all observers believe that he's been railroaded. So, you know, that could be brought more, that could be talked about more publicly. Also, the process of the elections themselves, the need for further measures to ensure freer and fairer elections in the future. I think, you know, statements, the bully pulpit could be used for that. But any strong-arm tactics, of course, would give the government the ability, the Egyptian government, the ability to rally nationalist sentiment and say, oh, we're standing up to the big bad Americans, and that wouldn't work. The second question I didn't quite understand.
Well, I think, well, in part it was about this, the business of succession.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Egypt, it seems that there is that President Mubarak has a son that he has been grooming to succeed him.
Okay.
We saw a similar situation in Syria, although the son that is now the president is not the one that his father had originally picked. Another brother had been picked. He was killed in a car accident. So then the son, Bashar, who nobody ever – this was not the guy that was supposed to be the president.
Right.
No, he is the president now. So is there some question, I guess, about how it is that the father, how does he decide who the successor is going to be? And then maybe the additional question is, if that person is clearly identified as being the one who's going to be the successor, then is that person in jeopardy because they're the one who's the anointed one, and are they likely to be a topic of a target for violent opposition?
I see. Well, the son's name is Gamal Mubarak, and he's the only son. He's the only son in this position. I don't think he's very likely to be a target of violence or assassination. I'm sure he has the second best security in the country after his father. Egyptian wags, about 5 or 6 years ago, I first heard this term, invented a new term, gumlukiya, which would translate as republarchy, in reference to Syria and also to the Egyptian situation. A republarchy is a republic, of course, but where you have monarchical succession of the leader. And already when Assad's son was moving to take his place, there was talk of Gamal Mubarak being groomed by his father to take over his place once Hosni Mubarak either passes away or decides to retire. Now, this has been stoutly denied by the president and his government all along the way, although Gamal has a very prominent position in the NDP, and there's some support for him. So it remains to be seen whether he will succeed or not. In a sense, the cat is out of the bag now, and they're almost kind of on notice that, well, if you do this, it's going to look really bad. But on the other hand, President Mubarak has been very careful to make sure that no one for the past 25 years has been a likely successor to himself. In the very early years of his presidency, there was a very popular defense minister whose name escapes me at the moment, but he was somebody that the Americans liked a lot. And there was a lot of talk in Washington about, oh, this Mubarak fellow, we don't know, but in the Reagan administration, but perhaps we could move, here we go again, the Americans wanting to change things. Here, maybe we could move this defense minister up into Mubarak's place. And before you could turn around, this guy was gone. And there's been no obvious number two since this time.
Let's come a little bit closer to where we are now and talk about the bombings that happened in Dahab last month. Number of people were killed. Most of them, I think, were Egyptian, but there were a number of foreigners killed because this was a popular site for tourists, for European tourists.
It's a very nice place. Yeah.
This was now the second time, I think, in maybe less than 2 years, there were bombings in Sinai, in resorts in the Sinai. Who was responsible for this, or does anyone know who was responsible for this?
Well, what we know is what the Egyptian authorities have told us, and that is that there is a group that has a name, Tawheed, Jihad, which means the assertion of monotheism and striving in the way of God. It was one of these generic terms for a Muslim organization. And they are largely Bedouin, that is to say, people of the native population of the Sinai Peninsula who no longer, but once upon a time, their ancestors were camel-herding Bedouin, I suppose. And beyond that, not much is known about them. Obviously, they would know the area very well, the terrain, I mean, and it's possible that they've been able to acquire weapons and explosives through criminal networks, because the Sinai is a great place for and has been for hundreds of years, but especially in recent times, a great place for smuggling of weapons, drugs, trafficked women between the across the Egyptian-Israeli frontier.
What are the aims of this group? What would they be hoping to achieve?
They have not articulated any aims, as far as I know. There's no manifesto that has come out, so we're left with sort of trying to divine what they might have meant, and the only thing I've seen in that vein is that the bombings have come close to Egyptian national holidays, but maybe that's a coincidence. Who knows?
And why the targeting of these areas, of these kinds of resort areas, like Dahab and Taba?
Well, if you want to try to garner some sympathy in the larger population with acts like this. Targeting resort hotels is, for the average person, I suppose, targeting these symbols of wealth and privilege, that is to say the Egyptians who can afford to go to these places and hang and spend a weekend luxuriating, are definitely have a higher income than the average Egyptian does. Most people can't afford to go to these places. And, of course, foreigners make use of these hotels. As I said, we went there and enjoyed it. And so as symbols of privilege, I suppose, they are logical things to attack. But again, what kind of message is being delivered or whether they have a clear idea of what of a strategy, it isn't apparent.
Mm-hmm. Well, does this say something about a change in the nature of militant armed opposition to the government?
I don't see that. I mean, this may be just a small group. It's hard mm-hmm. to say. They're in the Sinai, as far as we know, based upon what we know about the people involved, and they've actually apprehended or actually cornered and killed some of them in recent weeks. They seem not to be directly connected with the Jamaa Islamiyya, which declared a ceasefire in 1997. After waging essentially a war with the government, but that was a Nile Valley group, both based in the Cairo area and in Upper Egypt. So I'm not sure that it's too soon to tell whether this is a blip or something bigger. But so we just have to sort of wait and see. It's just not enough information to really say what's going on.
Yeah, I guess the thing I'm wondering about is having read some suggestions that it might mean that there would be more of these kinds of groups that would be smaller, mm-hmm. not affiliated with some sort of large organization, not amenable to central control, in a sense, a lot of small splinter groups that would be almost be freelancing, which would be a lot more difficult to deal with, would seem more difficult to deal with than if you were dealing with a much larger group that did indeed have some kind of centralized leadership.
Well, that's true. It's much, much harder to anticipate a small group like that coming from the local population, but they are also much less of a strategic threat of any sort. I mean, they're a security threat, and they can, you know, kill a few people as they managed to do this time. But they may be much easier also because of the small size and the amateurishness to roll up. As well.
Hmm. Well, one other thing, in response to this, the president extended the country's emergency law that had been in effect now ever since the assassination of Anwar Sadat, so mm-hmm. something like 25 mm-hmm. years. All the time Mr. Mubarak has been president, mm-hmm. this law has been in effect.
Yes.
And it was something that he had talked about finally suspending when he was running for re-election. It, among other things, allows the government to arrest people and hold them indefinitely without charge. And I guess there are a significant number of people that are held under this law. And I'm sure that the Democratic opposition would have liked to see this law gone because it also places limits on things like can you hold a rally and your activity
yes.
to organize and hold political events. I'm sure there must have been a lot of people who were disappointed that Mr. Mubarak said, well, we need to continue this law. And probably also people have said, well, isn't that convenient that he now has these bombings give him a reason, an excuse for saying, well, you know, it would be a nice thing if we suspended this law, but clearly we can't do that right now.
Yeah. And by the way, the emergency law was also in place most of the time during Nasser's and Sadat's presidencies as well, mm-hmm. although Mubarak has had it on more consistently. Right. The Egyptian constitution contains every conceivable guarantee of civil liberties that you would expect to be in a constitution, virtually all of which are suspended under the emergency law. And the main, as you mentioned, the main feature of it that's used by the government is detention without trial for lengthy periods of time. There is a limit on that of, I forget how many weeks or so or months, at which point they are released but not released and then just locked up again for a new term. Now, this is another area, getting back to that question of what the U.S. could do or what citizens could do to try to promote change. I mean, this is another area where internally it's being fought out. Now, the deputies, the large number of deputies in the parliament now The Muslim Brotherhood and the secular opposition showed up and during the vote and turned. And by the way, this was literally announced 24 hours in advance that they would bring this to the parliament for a vote, you know, in the hopes of sneaking it through. It got out. It leaked out, actually. And the opposition showed up wearing sashes saying, you know, no to the emergency law, we want freedom, and so forth and so on, and kind of created a demonstration. Now, mind you, they don't have anything. They've got like one-fifth of the parliament, so they have nothing approaching a majority. But at least they can make a bit more noise and be more visible now. And this is, again, something that could be highlighted a bit more by the Americans or the Europeans, sort of expressions of disapproval moves like this.
We're a bit past the midpoint here. I just want to take enough time to introduce again the guest, Kent Cuno. He's Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois. He's also Director of the Program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. We're talking about Egypt and recent events there. If you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, given everything that we've talked about here, we have President Mubarak in his fifth term, longest-serving leader in the Arab world, a man who seems to be putting together a dynasty, if indeed his son becomes president, significant opposition, religious opposition from this Islamist party, the Muslim Brotherhood, although they're not officially recognized, they can't officially participate as a party, but they now have some seats in parliament and it gives them a platform to criticize the government. Some other opposition, some secular opposition, but lost ground in the last election. Where does this all go, particularly for people who would like to promote democratic reform and a more democratic political system in the country?
Yeah, that's a good question. Where it's going? Of course, the answer as a historian, I must say, I don't know. historians don't feel obligated to predict the future. But one of the things we haven't talked about yet is that there is a continuing drama going on right now in Egypt over electoral reform, and this was a consequence of the parliamentary elections in the fall. The judges, the Egyptian judiciary, has been getting uppity, and a majority of them now have essentially staked out a position critical of the government in opposition to the government, and especially the National Democratic Party. What happened was that the judges are supposed to supervise the polling places, and over the past several election rounds, the judges have gotten more forceful and have won cases, enabling them to insist that that they are to supervise every single polling place rather than just some of them. And this is why the parliamentary elections had to be broken up into three rounds, because there aren't enough judges to go around at one go. Mm-hmm. But they were inside the polling places. Prior to the elections, a court had issued a decree that NGOs were to be allowed also in to observe, and the head of the elections commissions, who's a Mubarak man, declared that he would ignore this order. So NGOs were not permitted to observe. The worst excess happened outside the polling stations while the judges were being kept inside, watching the actual balloting, and so forth and so on. At any rate, a couple serving judges have alleged that publicly that some of their colleagues were complicit in vote rigging. Basically, they're taking the role of whistleblowers. The response of the Ministry of Justice was instead of investigating these allegations, they've charged these two whistleblowers with bringing the good name of the judiciary into disrepute, and they're on trial for this now, for essentially what amounts to slander. They're being prosecuted. As a result of that, there have been sit-ins. There has been a continuing sit-in by members of the judiciary at the Judges Club in Cairo for the past two or more weeks. There was a demonstration near the court building, including judges and others, that was attacked by the police at the end of last month. There is one judge who was beaten so badly he's still in hospital as a result of this. So imagine that the police attacking judges in the streets who are peacefully demonstrating. So it's not clear where this is going to go, but again, a little bit more attention on the part of our government and the European governments, not to mention the media, to these sorts of things would help. Simply by putting this out there in the sunlight, I think would help a great deal.
We have some other folks to talk with. Champaign County, the next caller. This is line one.
On the elections, I think I heard on the BBC that to become a candidate, you had to get signatures from government officials, elected government officials. Now, did that stand? And that sort of, in my mind, undermines the whole credibility of the process to begin with. I mean, do you know if that really is the way it happens?
Actually, I have no idea. I'm not sure about that. You may have been hearing something about there's a process of vetting candidates through a government commission. You know, they have to play by the rules.
Uh-huh. But, yeah, well, we know they disqualified a lot of people mm-hmm. in various ways, but I'm given to understand that you couldn't even get on the ballot unless you had a certain number of elected officials. It wasn't like a list of citizens petitioned by the citizens like we're kind of used to here. What I wanted to ask about was this opposition in the Sinai. The implication is that it's sort of, you know, sympathetic, but maybe it has sort of this very specific kind of regional grievance about the Sinai itself. But I'm wondering whether that includes the bigger idea that they're opposed to, you know, Camp David Accord, not the most recent one, but the one that Jimmy Carter signed, the idea of mm-hmm. making a deal with Israel and taking huge amounts of money from the U.S. Does that inform it as well? Or, I mean, I would gather that it would be, but as you say, they don't seem to put out any manifestos, right?
Well, that's it. They've adopted a name that is an Islamist name, so that gives you that, you know, so in terms of their general orientation, yes, Islamist of some sort. They, to my knowledge, have not said anything about the peace treaty with Israel as Islamists. Presuming they are Islamists, they would probably have something critical to say about that. Otherwise, the general take I have is that, yes, of course, at the recruitment end, how do you convince people to go over to the dark side and to become a revolutionary terrorist of this sort? There you've got the usual, what you would expect, high unemployment, discrimination against native Sinai people of Bedouin background in favor of Nile Valley Egyptians and so forth and so on. But again, we have such limited information, it's really hard at this point to sort of place them in some sort of a general trend, except perhaps through the copycat phenomenon whereby there's, you know, every so often there's something going on somewhere else, and so this is a kind of style that they can adopt that maybe makes them feel part of something larger.
As a Bedouin, I guess they're not inclined to look at land tenure, but I'm wondering if they don't partially think that as a no-man's zone prior to the settlement return to Egypt, it was actually, they may have had more... You know, obviously, a lot of land was taken to make resorts and other that actually wouldn't consume a lot of territory, but roads, et cetera, et cetera. So they could have a very parochial grievance. And as you mentioned, the combination of that and unemployment and the general antipathy to U.S. and Israeli policy.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned development of the resorts. Now, let me go back to your first point about Bedouin and land. Don't assume that because we're using this term Bedouin or nomad, well, nomad isn't the right term, don't assume that they are nomads. We're talking about people who could be as many as three generations removed from a nomadic lifestyle. So the term Bedouin, or more often in Egypt, simply Arab, is applied to these people in the same way that we would refer to a fellow American as Irish or German or something like that. In other words, in reference to their ancestors. But with regard to the development, especially of tourism in the Sinai, since the return of it to Egypt, which was in 1982, in talking to people, and it's a wonderful place to go for a holiday, and we've done this many times. And you chat with people. We speak Arabic, and talking to various people who are native Sinai, Bedouin, quote-unquote, typically they're taxi drivers and other service people, they'll tell you flat out, right, we had to put up with the Israelis, and now it's like a second occupation. All the good jobs are going to what they call Egyptians, meaning people from the Nile Valley, and including the store proprietors and so forth, and they end up with kind of the low-end jobs like driving taxi or sweeping up and stuff like that. So there is this definite sense of grievance, almost of an ethnic sort, if you will.
This is belaboring the obvious, but you're saying that the Egyptians call themselves whatever their term for Egyptian is, and they call the Bedouins and others
Arabs.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So they're sort of identifying with Saudi Arabs.
No. Arab is the original word for a Bedouin. In old Arabic, inside Egypt, amongst Egyptians, just as you and I would refer to somebody as Irish or Japanese or something like that, who happens to be a third-generation American, inside of Egypt, Egyptians refer to each other as Arabs if they have an Arab Bedouin lineage, tribal lineage, and that's all it refers to. But it's no more than simply calling an American Irish because his ancestors are Irish.
But Masri is the...
Masri, yeah.
Masri is the term for Egyptian, then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think so. It's just a... I mean, in the so-called West here, or whatever we are, the North, we have a lot of people just, like, say, those are all Arabs, and we obviously, this isn't even a subtle point, but the distinctions are important to know I am belaboring the obvious. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, let's go and talk to someone else here. Line number two. This caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to get back to your discussion of the Muslim Brotherhood. Uh-huh. I missed some of the programs, so you might have talked about this, but I was wondering if the issue, first, of the relationship with the Copts, who supposedly make up about 10% of the Egyptian population, and there's been ongoing conflict even under the current situation, whether that would be exacerbated significantly if the Muslim Brotherhood came to power. And also, since you talked a little bit about their use of Sharia, I wonder how things like the current fatwa against idols and all the relics of the pharaohs, how that would be affected by Muslim Brotherhood. And then, of course, that spills over into the whole tourist trade, the income from people coming to view the various pharaoh, the pyramids, etc.
Right. Okay, thank you. Well, I'm glad you raised this religious question, because I don't think we had talked up to now about the Christian-Muslim relations in Egypt. And you're right that the Copts, Coptic Christians, who are the native Christian Church of Egypt, the national church, if you will, are somewhere between 7 and 10% of the entire population. Things recently have taken a turn for the worse. There have been a couple incidents in Alexandria, the second city of Egypt on the Mediterranean. Last month, there was a series of stabbings in churches by an individual Muslim. And a few months before, there were some intercommunal riots touched off by a videotape of a play, I think, which Muslims believed was anti-Islamic. So these incidents simply show that there's greater tension. Tension between Muslims and Christians in Egypt has developed since about 1970, starting in the presidency of Sadat, and is coinciding with the Muslim Brotherhood being permitted to operate semi-legally after having been repressed for the most of the previous 20 years. And on one level, I suppose you can see these tensions and conflicts as a product of the dire economic and social situation. But at the same time, you're correct in your surmising that the the electoral advance of the Muslim Brotherhood, their greater clout at the polls, greater visibility, has led to according to what I've been hearing actually from Egyptian friends recently, a bit more public intolerance toward non-Muslims, toward Christians, but also toward people who don't conform outwardly or obviously to some sort of conservative Islamic ideal, for example, not a woman not covering her hair. And here I think that the Mubarak government has failed badly to use the bully pulpit to encourage more of a tolerant atmosphere in the country, although they have fallen back on some standard things like having the Sheikh al-Azhar and the Pope meet together and having government-sponsored demonstrations for people who hold the Bible and the Quran together and like that. But that's not really addressing the issue. Coptic Egyptians, Christian Egyptians, have a lot of complaints about unequal treatment. I don't know if we've got time to go into it.
We're at the point where maybe we have about 5 minutes.
Oh, okay, that's
left.
Fine. Then.
Yeah.
Then, I mean, one thing is that to build a new church or repair an existing church, you have to get government approval, presidential approval. That's an old Ottoman law, but it's still on the books and it hasn't been changed. There are also in Egyptian statute law, it is illegal to convert from Islam to another religion, but not the other way around. And there have been some difficulties and problems with that. And also intercommunal Christian-Muslim relations are also strained when a Christian prominently or publicly converts to Islam. Sometimes this is done for the purpose of getting a divorce by a woman, because the as an Eastern church, the Coptic church doesn't permit divorce. But, of course, it is permitted in Islam. But even when that happens, which is legal, still this causes strains, intercommunal strains. All but the upper-class Copts will also tell you that there's a lot of discrimination, illegal, informal discrimination in the workplace and in education and elsewhere, and there are complaints over that. But this kind of violence is rather untypical and episodic. I think most Egyptians see themselves as a very tolerant nation, and they most Egyptians, especially the educated Egyptians, will acknowledge that there is really a dual Muslim-Christian heritage to the country. On a day-by-day basis, relations are pretty good, but we have these problems, and again, they aren't being really treated.
I think one of the things that I read, and you correct me if this is wrong, but in all of the parliament, well more than 400 members, there's only one Coptic Christian member.
Well, the NDP, I think I read, only ran two candidates who were Christian and one lost. Now, 10 of the seats, 10 of the 454 seats are appointed, and the president typically will appoint women and Christians to these seats. Because the NDP doesn't run that many and they don't do very well when they do run.
Well, quickly here, and maybe we have about a minute, I wonder if you could address the other question, the concern that if the Muslim Brotherhood should come to power in Egypt, would they do what the Taliban did, and would they be going around starting to destroy monuments surviving from culture of ancient Egypt?
I think they're more sophisticated than that. I think that their decision not contest all the parliamentary seats, for example, shows a fair degree of sophistication. And actually, since the fall elections, these kinds of concerns have been raised. And so the Muslim Brotherhood has officials have now made some statements that they have no intention of bringing back some of the pre-modern restrictions on non-Muslims, like paying this special tax, which used to be up until the 1850s was levied on Christians and Jews. And so forth. But they certainly haven't gone all the way to saying they want total equality or dealing with these issues that I mentioned earlier. As for the fatwa, it was a fatwa about statues, actually, which was very bizarre, and not issued by a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. He's somebody with some kind of religious qualifications. I don't remember exactly who it was. But it's certainly not binding in the legal sense. It's an opinion. There can be multiple fatwas issued by various people with religious learning. And this one simply got attention because it's so odd.
Hmm. We're just about at the point where we have to finish up here. Obviously, we've touched on a lot of things. Is there any sort of final idea that your final thought you'd like to offer here as at least we wrap up for the moment?
Oh, good question. Well, I would say for people who are interested in this, keep your eye on these demonstrations by the judges and this whole question of because this could also reveal the extent to which there was ultimately election rigging or not last fall, and this might be the wedge that sort of opens things up and makes the next elections a little bit more open.
All right. Well, we will continue to watch, and perhaps we can talk again on another day. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Our guest, Ken Cuno, he is Associate Professor of History and Director of the Program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies here at the University of Illinois. This program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Funds for this day of broadcasting also come in part from a contribution by the family of Bill Williamson, wishing him a very happy birthday today. For 18 years, Kathy and Bruce Harrison have been foster parents. They've cared for more than 120 children, including a little girl named Daisy. Kathy Harrison tells Daisy's story in the book One Small Boat, the story of a little girl lost and found. Why did she write about Daisy? Well, she hopes that we'll see the real children hiding within the statistics. There are more than 500,000 kids in the child welfare system in the United States. Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, Kathy Harrison will be talking with the host of the show, Celeste Quinn. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the program. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with the usual mix of news and sports and weather and other things. Also on the Afternoon Magazine today at 2:40 following the closing market report, Celeste will talk with the executive director of the Champaign County Court-Appointed Special Advocates, Genevieve Lambert. Champaign County CASA is a not-for-profit organization that recruits, trains, and monitors volunteers who advocate for the best interests of abused and neglected children. So all of that coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, and the show gets underway at noon here on AM 580. Coming up in the next part of this show, we'll be talking about some of the challenges that people face as they care for their aging parents, and our guest will be Dr. Linda Rhodes. She is, among other things, the former Secretary of Aging for the state of Pennsylvania. She's currently head of an organization called Linda Rhodes Caregiving. She's written a couple of books on the subject, and she'll talk with us in the next hour. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets and news, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri-Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Producing a renewable fuel with corn